the two victims at Post Road, the one victim at Boland Street, and two from the Valley of the Moon Park.
The gun used to shoot an Anchorage officer on Saturday is linked to five city homicides. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, will a President Trump clear a path for the Pebble Mine?
Mr. Trump campaigned on halting and reversing the EPA overreach across, you know, the country.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. It's a fact. 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
The Anchorage Police Department today identified the two officers and suspect involved in a fatal weekend shooting. And as APRN's Alaska Public Media's Josh Edge reports, police say the gun used by the suspect in Saturday's shooting has now been linked to five Anchorage murders.
APD identified the suspect in Saturday morning's shooting as 40-year-old James Dale Ritchie. Lieutenant John McKinnon is commander of the department's homicide and robbery assault section. He says the Colt Python 357 Ritchie used has been linked to five other Anchorage homicides this summer from early July through late August.
The two victims at Post Road, the one victim at Boland Street, and two from the Valley of the Moon Park.
McKinnon says detectives met with the victims' families Tuesday morning to relay the new information. APD Police Chief Chris Tully identified the officers involved in Saturday's shooting, beginning with injured officer Arne Salau, a five-year veteran of the department.
He immediately returned gunfire and physically fought off his assailant. At the same time, as this is occurring, a second officer who's in the area rolled up on the incident, and Sergeant Mark Patsky of our K-9 unit charged and returned fire. And together, they were able to stop this individual.
Ritchie was killed in the gun battle. During the attack, Chief Tolley says Officer Salau was shot at least four times in the lower part of his body.
Even though he's hit in the lower part of the body and entered the body in the lower extremes, the bullets traveled and went up into the middle of his body, fracturing bones, ripping apart muscle, ripping through his intestines, and even lodging in the liver.
Despite the seriousness of the injuries, Chief Tolley says after two surgeries, Officer Salau's condition is now listed as stable.
I'm happy to tell you that despite some infections setting in over the weekend, we think we're past that, and the officer actually got up. He's been moved out of ICU, and the officer has been up and begun to try to take some steps.
And after visiting the wounded officer Tuesday in the hospital, Chief Tolley says Officer Salau plans on taking even more steps. Saturday's incident began when Officer Salau made contact with James Ritchie while investigating a report of a theft stemming from a man who refused to pay his cab fare. But Lieutenant McKinnon says Ritchie was not that man.
I know that Mr. Ritchie was in the area during the event, and so we would contact people as if they were witnesses, if they saw anybody, hey, where did you see someone matching this description? And so he is not the person that was involved in the cab theft.
And McKinnon says Ritchie's motive for opening fire is not immediately clear.
We're not sure what the suspect was thinking or what was going through his thoughts. All we do know is that he immediately goes at the officer and produces a handgun and shoots at him multiple times.
McKinnon says APD will not release video, citing its graphic nature, as well as an effort to preserve evidence in ongoing cases. As part of its ongoing investigation, McKinnon says the case, along with the five murders associated with the weapon, remains open. He says investigators will continue to look into Ritchie's past, including other places he may have lived, to find out if there are any other cases to which he may be linked. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Alaska Native leaders from across the state are gathered in Fairbanks for a tribal self-governance symposium. The three-day event is sponsored by University of Alaska Fairbanks, the University of Arizona, the Tanana Chiefs Conference, and the Casey Foundation. One of the organizers, UAF Assistant Professor of Tribal Management, Carrie Stevens, says the symposium grew out of a similar tribal gathering in Fairbanks last fall on co-management of fish and game.
We had over 200 participants at that historic event. It was very successful. And from that event, there was a request by Native Nations Institute at the University of Arizona to hold this event.
Stephen says the symposium aims to identify ways Alaska tribes can strengthen their governments. And another organizer, UAF Associate Professor of Tribal Management Kevin Illingworth, points to recent years' agreements with the state on several fronts.
Child protection has definitely been a key area that we've seen a lot of collaboration happening. We're also seeing collaboration and partnership happening in working with youth. And also in the broad area of public safety.
Another avenue by which Alaska tribes can expand jurisdiction is placing lands into federal trust. Trust status in Alaska was affirmed by a federal court ruling this summer, but Stephen says tribes are already well aware of the potential.
The first case regarding land into trust was in the 90s here in Alaska, and so it's been discussed for decades. And I think that a lot of tribes are well aware of the pluses and minuses of land into trust, and that it is seen as one tool to help benefit the well-being of tribal membership.
The Tribal Governance Symposium, which includes keynote addresses and roundtable discussions, runs through Thursday. As a candidate, President-elect Donald Trump said he'd liberate business by striking as much as 70% of federal regulations. Trump vowed to dump Obama-era policies and unleash the energy industry to produce more oil, gas, and coal. It would seem like good times for natural resource extraction in Alaska. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Trump will find some policies easier to dismantle than others.
President Obama's policies for Alaska are embedded in a variety of documents: executive orders, memoranda, agency action, and formal rules. Some can be undone with the stroke of a pen. Consider the Pebble Mine, a massive project proposed for southwest Alaska that opponents say is a threat to the salmon runs of Bristol Bay. Pebble spokesman Mike Keatwall says it's unlikely Trump would want to continue the EPA's effort to block the mine using the so-called veto authority in the Clean Water Act.
Mr. Trump campaigned on halting and reversing the EPA overreach across, you know, the country.
Heatwall says he doesn't know if Trump has specifically taken a position on Pebble, but he says he sees no reason why Trump's EPA wouldn't just reverse course.
Certainly the EPA's, you know, preemptive actions against Pebble, could probably call it a poster child in that regard in terms of EPA overreach.
Earth Justice attorney Tom Waldo also says there's nothing stopping the EPA from making a U-turn on Pebble.
Yes, I think it's entirely possible that EPA in a Trump administration may choose not to continue the process.
Waldo says he hopes Pebble won't get the financing it needs to proceed, and if it does, it will still need federal permits.
There are laws that protect the resources in Alaska and in the United States, and there are procedures that agencies are required to go through in making changes. And we will be vigilant to ensure that the laws are obeyed and the procedures are followed.
President Obama has issued hundreds of executive orders and memos that Trump can undo once he takes office. But some of Obama's Alaska policy is enshrined in formal rules, and they're more firmly set. Among them are restrictions on predator hunting in Alaska's national preserves and refuges, which opponents see as Obama intruding on Alaska's right to manage fish and game, and Arctic drilling standards. The so-called WOTUS rule, defining which waters are subject to the Clean Water Act, would also have a big impact in Alaska.
It takes a lot of work to overturn a policy that has already been set by a rule.
That's Tom Lorenzen, a Washington, D.C. lawyer at the firm Kroll and Mooring. He used to work for the government defending EPA regulations. Generally, to toss a regulation, you have to go through the same laborious rulemaking procedure it took to get the reg on the books, with notices, public comment periods, and a lot of documentation. It can take a year or more. And then, Lorenzen says, whatever group liked the rule as it was will likely sue.
Well, I'll tell you, I have been through two transitions from Clinton to Bush and from Bush to Obama, both inside the Department of Justice, and it is not as easy as people might lead one to believe.
Case in point, the roadless rule for national forests. President Bill Clinton's regulation lives on despite the Bush administration's best efforts to kill it. We'll see if President Trump takes a stab. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Anchorage Dakota Pipeline protesters show solidarity with the Standing Rock Sioux.
We're facing resource extraction here that impacts a lot of Indigenous people's lands.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line.
Alaskans joined protesters around the country today, staging demonstrations against the Dakota Access Pipeline Project, including two in Anchorage and one in downtown Juneau. The Standing Rock Sioux are protesting the project in North Dakota because they worry it will harm their water supply and disturb sacred sites. The cause has drawn support from Native and environmental groups nationwide. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk reports.
Monday evening, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers continued their hold on the Dakota Access Pipeline Project, saying additional discussion and analysis are warranted. But the decision isn't final, and protests went ahead as planned. In downtown Anchorage, about 50 demonstrators gathered at Town Square Park to protest Wells Fargo for financing the project, chanting, "Water is life." Kirby Spangler is with the environmental group Alaska Rising Tide. He helped organize the demonstration. Spangler said he was there for two reasons: to protest fossil fuel development because he's concerned about climate change, and to support Indigenous rights.
Both of which have huge implications for Alaska's future.
Lisa Wade of Chickaloon Village just got back from North Dakota after visiting the protest there. She says Alaska Native people recognize the Standing Rock Sioux tribe's concerns.
I think that we are facing a lot of the same issues. We are facing resource extraction here that impacts a lot of Indigenous people's lands.
Protesters marched from Town Square Park to the Wells Fargo branch in the Anchorage Fifth Avenue Mall, where Wade closed two bank accounts. Police officers arrived to monitor the scene, but after about half an hour, the protesters left the building peacefully and no arrests were made. In an emailed statement, Wells Fargo's Alaska spokesman David Kennedy said the bank respects the differing opinions involved in this dispute. He added the bank is taking a look at issues the situation in North Dakota has raised, but he added Wells Fargo doesn't comment on its relationships with specific customers. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
In rural Alaska, access to fresh and local produce is limited at best during the fall and winter. But some Alaskan farmers are exploring options that let them keep their produce out of the elements. From KDLG in Dillingham, Avery Lill has more.
So it's just a hydroponic system. It's got water with fertilizer and calcium in it.
Okay.
Nutrients, and that water just comes up through.
No wind, no critters, no rain. Just the whir of machines and the smell of basil greet Kyle Balek as he inspects his hydroponic garden. This Dillingham resident and lifelong rural Alaskan has been gardening for years, but this year is the first time he's grown a garden in a box, a containerized growing system to be more precise. Rows of succulent lettuce, kale, and chard fill floor-to-ceiling shelves on either side of this shipping container that has been converted into a hydroponic farm.
What are we growing? Well, lettuce is the main thing. You see, there's green leaf, here's some young green leaf, there's some green leaf, some red leaf. The butterhead stuff's pretty popular. Got some romaine growing. And then different greens. We got chard, kale, mizuna.
He's also started to grow some herbs. The basil and arugula in particular are really taking off. Year-round fresh access to local produce has long been nearly impossible for rural Alaskans. And for Bilek, that's the draw to hydroponic gardening.
Well, you can grow all year. It'll look like this in January. It'll look like this in February. It'll look like this next June. I mean, it's just, you can keep growing. You can just keep growing and keep growing and keep growing.
Hydroponics gives Bleck the chance to grow year-round, but it also makes his farming operation more efficient.
One of the things that makes it almost more economical than trying to garden out in the field, because it doesn't take much time. It really doesn't. I spend, you know, now that it's up and running well, I don't know, 10 hours a week plus a few more hours to harvest and deliver stuff. So it's really not that much of a time commitment.
And that frees him up for marketing. Bleck Family Farms began selling their produce at the AC grocery store in Dillingham. He's the first hydroponic farmer in town, but not the first in Alaska. Bleck is a part of a larger movement to grow fresh food in rural Alaska. Renee Perez manages the produce division for AC Value Centers, and he says that his stores are partnering with two other hydroponic farms, one in Kotzebue and one in Southeast Island School District.
That is one of our top priorities as far as the produce division is concerned, is to support locally grown and the local industry.
Vicki McDonald is the branch manager of the AC in Dillingham. And she has been impressed by the quality of Bleck's hydroponically grown greens.
He picked it the same day he brings it, which you can taste the difference compared to what we were getting before, which was getting shipped from Washington or, you know.
And she says that customers have been glad to see Bleck Farm on their shelves.
It's been so well accepted. Everyone who's, you know, come in has just been like, oh, this is really good.
Bleck's other customer is the Dillingham City School District. Danny Frazier is the superintendent. He says that when they ship produce from other parts of the state or country, sometimes as much as half of it comes in wilted or frozen.
We get fresher produce, of course, and it's something that the kids seem really happy to get, and they're eating it. So it's something we want to do.
Bleck Family Farms is starting out with two shipments a week to the AC, one or two shipments a week to the school, and already has other interested customers. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
A fire in Emonic has damaged the local water treatment plant. Emonic's mayor, Wilbur Hooch, says the cause of the fire is a suspected pump overload. The fire damaged the main vacuum pump. Technicians are working to keep community pipes from freezing. To do that, a main storage water tank must be filled. Hooch says a failure to fill that tank could be costly.
If we don't have enough water level in our 100,000-plus storage tank, once the high and low pressure freeze up, we'll have a major disaster for the whole community of Emonic.
Tonight, Mayor Hooch will hold an emergency meeting to approve the budget for needed repairs. City engineers are currently ordering the replacement parts. If the parts aren't available, the system may freeze. While water is still running now, Hooch says only 3 of the remaining 9 feet in the community storage tank is usable.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
From military might to counterculture cool to camo chic, camouflage in plain sight exposes the ancient yet modern art of concealment. See camouflage at the Anchorage Museum through February the 5th. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum.
President-elect Donald Trump made many a campaign promise during his run for the White House, such as shutting down the Environmental Protection Agency and killing the Affordable Care Act. But none of Trump's rhetorical pledges may have affected Alaskans, like his Twitter vow to rename Denali. Orville Huntington, Parks Director with the Tanana Chiefs Conference, is from the Koyukuk Athabascan village of Huslia.
Well, I can only speak from the interior Athabascans. It's always been called Denali. We never really called it any other name. But every mountain has four names depending on which direction you're traveling. So for us, we're going toward the south. And, you know, you see Denali, it's pretty prominent. And so that's why it got the name. And it's always been the name, far as I know. We've never called it anything else.
Huntington says the name Denali means the Great One. He says Alaska Native names of the mountain could be different depending on which of the Athabascan or Denaina languages are spoken.
I wouldn't know. You'd have to go to the Denaina name. It may be the same, and I have no idea what it is in Upper Tanana. I don't know that language.
To many Alaskans, it has always been Denali. And after last year's visit to Alaska to promote his environmental agenda, President Barack Obama announced his administration's recognition of Denali as the official name. President-elect Trump took to Twitter, "Great insult to Ohio," and vowed to change Denali back to Mount McKinley. Ohio, the home state of William McKinley, the mountain's namesake, also figured prominently in Trump's campaign agenda as one of the hotly contested battleground states. It remains to be seen if Trump will follow through on his promise. If you're a dedicated public radio listener, then the dulcet tones of longtime journalist Corey Flintoff are familiar to you. Flintoff retired in October after 27 years with NPR. He got his start in public broadcasting at KYUK in Bethel and then for APRN in Anchorage before he was hired by NPR to be a foreign correspondent. Flintoff says his first assignment was in New Delhi, where he had easy access to officials within India's government. But his last assignment in Moscow, not so much. Flintoff says he routinely asked for comment from the Kremlin for every story and was turned down for every story. He also knew it was likely that his phone and computer were monitored. He said he and a Russian colleague were followed by two middle-aged plainclothes police officers recently when they were after a story outside of Moscow.
And we discovered that they followed us everywhere we went. There was even an embarrassing moment for them when we got lost. You know, Kaliningrad is a city of canals and bridges, and we took a wrong turn. And as soon as we realized that we were going the wrong way, we immediately pivoted around and started back across the bridge. And of course, there they were, caught red-handed, and they both had to turn to their cell phones, you know, and pretend to be very, very busy as we passed by.
Did you wave?
No, but we were almost on waving. We were almost on a waving basis by the time we finished up. I would certainly have waved and said hello, but they were having none of it.
So you didn't have to develop some sort of NPR code language to talk to your colleagues in Washington?
No, by and large, you know, I talked about exactly what I was going to do, you know, and whether it was damaging to the Russian government or not. And I never had any feedback from stories before they were actually published. I used to get scolded from time to time by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs when I did something that was particularly uncomplimentary either to Mr. Putin or to the Kremlin in general, but I was never threatened. They never said they'd take away my visa or anything like that. They just let me know that they were displeased.
Corey, it sounds like a screenplay. Are you planning to write about your adventures and your reporting work in Russia or on a larger scale in some of your other international assignments?
You know, I probably will, but I don't know whether I'll write it in the form of a memoir or a journal or something like that. I think I may find other ways to work that experience into my writing. And one of the things that I'm hoping to do is write fiction. So, you know, I've already been trying out a few stories and themes from my travels definitely make their way into the stories.
Why did you decide it was time to retire from NPR?
Well, For one thing, I just turned 70, and I decided that's long enough for a working life, and also long enough to work for one company. And plus, there are a couple things. You know, foreign reporting is difficult and tiring because you're basically on call 24/7. You know, you can be called up in the middle of the night and expected to be ready to travel somewhere immediately, or, you know, to stay up all night working on a story. And that's quite common for foreign correspondents. So that was difficult. And the other thing is, you know, I met a lot of really promising, really interesting young journalists who are just getting started in Eastern European reporting. I met most of them in Eastern Ukraine, you know, during the Ukrainian war there. And, you know, at a certain point, you have to realize you have to make a place for these people to come to work in a company like NPR.
Well, as we discussed earlier, Corey, you got your start in radio here in Alaska, first at KYUK in Bethel and then for APRN in Anchorage. You've reported from a lot of different states and countries through the years. How does public radio in Alaska compare to the other places that you've worked?
What we said about public radio in Alaska when I was there is still true, and that is that public radio is probably more important in Alaska than it is any place else in the United States. And since I've been working for NPR, I've traveled to a lot of places, including some stations in fairly remote places. But the transportation network in the lower 48 is so good that, you know, there are no stations that are as isolated as the ones in Alaska. There are no communities that need public radio as much as communities in Alaska do. You know, we've got the kind of people who would read the New York Times if they could get it every day, and people who would read the New Yorker, and people who have a need for serious and thoughtful and nuanced journalism. And the way they get it in many Alaskan communities is through their public radio stations.
Longtime NPR journalist and former Alaska Public Radio Network reporter Corey Flintoff retired in October after more than three decades in broadcast journalism. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Josh Edge, Ellen Lockyer, and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Tyler Stupp in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Avery Lill in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.